This still photograph captures one particular moment in time that will never be repeated. So at first glance, it seems like a photo can't fundamentally change once it's printed off. But context is everything. Imagine a picture of a man in a tuxedo in the back of a horse-drawn carriage decorated with a flower garland, smiling under a cloud-dappled sky. If I tell you this photo is lovingly displayed in a frame on a bedside table, your mind instantly fills in a certain kind of story, right? But if you come upon that exact same picture in a dumpster, torn in half so that whoever might have been on the other side of that carriage is missing from the image, the forever after part of the story changes. Maybe instead of the start of a beautiful life together, this picture was actually of the day two people made the worst mistake of their lives. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That dramatic shift in context may be happening to all the photos we hold on to throughout our lives, but it is starkly, poignantly, fascinatingly apparent for the ones we throw away. And my guest, who has spent decades dumpster diving as a way of understanding American values based on what we decide is not worth keeping, he's found thousands of discarded photos over the years, photos of events he never attended, people he has no connection to, yet he's found it really hard to let them go. Jeff Farrell is a sociologist, founding and current editor of the New York University Press book series Alternative Criminology, and one of the founding editors of the journal Crime, Media, Culture. His new book, which features a selection of photos he's found among the other detritus, is called Last Picture. Jeff, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How did you get interested in the stuff people throw away?
I've always been fascinated by the margins of society. I, for some reason, always feel most comfortable around the edges and the shadows. So the research I've done has always been with marginalized groups. But for me personally, dumpster diving also was a way to encounter the world from the bottom up, and really also for decades now, a way of living independently and in a sort of self-sustaining way, as well as hoping to intervene in environmental waste. And much of what I find, I try to get to charities. And so it's also, I guess, a sort of wealth redistribution as well.
You often stick to wealthier neighborhoods, I guess, because rich people throw a lot of good stuff away.
That's right. The discards of the wealthy are better than what I would have bought in the first place. So I have a very privileged life by mining the discards of those who are themselves more privileged than I am.
What is the range of things you found over the years?
It's really remarkable. Anything that you might have in your home, I've found. And in fact, my entire home is furnished with scrounged goods. So our kitchenware, all of our toiletries, all of our living room furniture and art, not all of the furniture now, but over the years, much of the furniture, tools, parts, books, toys, really anything that you can imagine in someone's life at some point gets discarded and becomes part of either the trash stream or, for those of us who dumpster dive, becomes part of our lives.
How do you decide what to leave behind in those dumpsters and what to take away?
Well, not to sound overly noble, but my real passion is to get items to those who need them. And over the years, I've learned and worked with various charities to know that, for example, the homeless shelter needs boots and tennis shoes and backpacks, and the women's shelter needs children's supplies and baby supplies. So I'm especially focused on digging out of the trash what others might be able to use, so taking waste and turning it into a resource.
With all due respect to the work that you do, it seems like that's a middle step that is unnecessary. Do you have any idea why people throw things away rather than donate them directly?
I do, and that's a question that comes up and has come up for years. Two answers I would have quickly. One is that people at least believe themselves to be in a hurry and believe their lives to be oversubscribed, and perhaps they are. And so I find that for them, making a trip to the shelter or to the donation center seems like more of a burden than just tossing them in the nearest dumpster. But I think it also has to do with American individualism and the Protestant work ethic and the notion that if you succeed, that shows that you've made the right choice and lived the right kind of life. The sad of that is if you don't succeed, it implies in our culture sometimes that you've made bad choices and don't deserve to be successful. And so I think there's a real sad, really sad ethos of not giving to those in need because somehow they're seen as unworthy. So sadly, I think there are folks who would rather throw their baby clothes or their tools in a dumpster than to give them to those who could use them.
So I imagine there are some neighborhoods where you're familiar enough that people are like, oh, it's just Farrell digging through the trash. I also imagine some people might be bothered by this, but what's the law around this? Once you thrown something away, have you given up all your rights to privacy over those items?
You have. The Supreme Court has ruled you have given up your rights, but the owner of that dumpster has not given up their rights to their own trash. So technically, dumpster diving is almost always illegal, or is at least possibly a charge that could be made of trespassing or illegally obtaining goods. As you say, I grew up in this area. I was gone for a quarter of a century, but I've been back now for 20 years in the same neighborhood. And as you suggested, at this point, I get in very little trouble because people know who I am. They know I'll clean up around the dumpster. They even put things out for me if they have extras, or come running out saying, I have more of that. Do you need it? So it's gotten to be, I guess, or almost I've gotten to be a member of the community more than a threat. But certainly some see you as a threat and are afraid you're going to steal information or leave a mess or that sort of thing.
How rare is it to find photographs in people's trash?
Not rare at all. That's, again, I should clarify, I never set out to scrounge old photos. They just kept turning up. And countless times tearing open a garbage bag and realizing it's full not only of old clothing and old parts, but of photos, or opening the lid on a discarded shoebox and finding carefully layered photos. So over the years, as you suggested in your introduction, I've accumulated many thousands of these photos and am now reluctant to let them go because I feel a certain dignity has been restored by saving them from the landfill.
It's an anomaly for you, though, right? Because everything else you take and redistribute or keep for your own use, it has practical value. Photographs are something different.
True. By the way, I should add, my partner would disagree with that characterization because I do, in fact, keep old glass doorknobs and old pocket knives. So I have certain treasures that I love so much that I'll admit I have dozens of pocket knives and dozens of glass doorknobs and glass bricks. But yes, mostly I'm looking for things that I or someone else can use. These photos present an interesting dilemma because they are, in a sense, without utility, and yet to see them is to bring back so many emotions and such a sense of historical memory that they become part of my life once they've been left from someone else's life.
So for whatever reason, these images are deemed to be unimportant enough to be tossed into a trash bin, but they were all important at one time, right? Especially in the days when taking a photo meant the cost of that frame of film and it meant the cost of printing it out. It used to be that every photo cost some money, and so people took pictures of things that had meaning to them.
Very good point. And that's where I think I feel a certain tenderness toward the photos, or a certain empathy, is, as you say, almost without exception, these are photos that mattered to someone. It mattered to pose that child in front of that birthday cake, or to get that last photo of your grandmother the last time you saw her. These are meaningful photos that have now lost their meaning because they've been discarded. I suppose in some ways I'm trying to restore that meaning or to rediscover it. And the other tragedy, I suppose, or at least the pathos of it, is that you begin to realize by the context in which you find the photos that they almost always come from an elderly person passing away, or at least maybe leaving their home and going to a nursing home. And so now the family throws everything away. They come from divorces and breakups. They come from your oldest daughter going off to college and you're cleaning out her room and finding photos that you don't want and she's left behind. So they're not only markers of people's emotions and things that matter to them, they also become markers of family dissolution, change, tragedy, the very kind of pathos of human life.
Yeah, you know, you say pathos. I don't spend a lot of time in dumpsters. There are a few pieces of furniture in my house that have been scrounged. But I come upon them at estate sales, which I visit just because I love to just piece together people's lives. And it always makes me a little bit sad, right? Because we, of all the things we keep photographs throughout our entire lives, certain that at some point we will pass them on. And so often they just don't have any meaning to that next generation.
That's right. Or if they might have meaning to that generation, maybe not the next one. So exactly. I think we think of these as timeless treasures, but it's all but inevitable that at some point they will sort of come unstuck, come loose from family history, or come loose from the original context. And as you say, whether that's an estate sale, or I do not do this, but I understand you can buy old photos online now. There's marketplaces for those. It's in a sense a kind of collective tragedy, or at least the collective humanity of these photos is that they are meant to last. They're meant to be timeless, but by definition or by the very nature of our lives, they are not timeless. They become less meaningful over at some point.
You often think about these photos as allowing you to see ghosts.
That in all the years of scrounging these photos, and as I begin to display them and write about them. That was the metaphor that was the strongest by far. If we put aside supernatural considerations, mostly what ghostly tends to mean is the presence of absence, that my grandmother's long gone, that house I once lived in has been destroyed, yet I still sense it, I still feel it in the presence, in the present. And so ghostliness or haunting is the notion of somehow the past still being there in the present, that which is absent still being part of our lives. And so, of course, these photos, both as material objects and as memories of people's events, are lost, they're gone, and yet to see them again is to experience a kind of ghostly resurrection of those old emotions and situations.
I think, is this right that pretty much every culture known has some kind of ghost tradition?
Precisely. I think that's because, again, we think maybe of Casper or bad Hollywood movies or bad novels. But really, I think, again, ghostliness is in a sense the power that the past holds over us, even when we think we've discarded it. And also the fact that absence is itself a phenomenon, that to miss someone is to, who's gone now, is to acknowledge that their absence still is a force in your life. And so, as you say, these images are ghostly not only in terms of how they've gotten lost, but they're ghostly because upon being rediscovered, they suddenly shock us with the lost memory or the image of a past time we thought was forgotten.
Do you find yourself dwelling most on the subjects of the photograph or on the person who held on to that photograph for however long?
Ah, exactly. Well, often, again, I can only deduce. One of the hardest things as a dumpster diver is not writing stories in your head based on scant evidence. So when I find old photos in a dumpster with some old clothing or some old tools, it's tempting to write a story about that person, but I can't really know. And so I tend to focus more on the photos as objects. And the other thing I would say is that by not knowing the people in the photo, it in a sense frees you to examine it as a photo, to think about the aesthetics, the shadowing, the foreground, the focus. You can in some ways more easily think about the history of photography and the nature of human photography collectively, when in fact you don't know the woman or the man or the dog in the photo.
There's one picture that really stuck with me. It's clearly Christmas. There's an elaborate tree. There's very expensive wallpaper on the walls and drapery, maybe the early 70s. And there's a little girl, maybe with her two sisters or cousins, looking at this pinball machine, which is like the world's greatest, you know, Christmas present. And then also in the frame are a black woman, the little girl is white, a black woman in a maid's uniform, a black man who may have been a party guest, but is also probably wearing some kind of butler's uniform. And they're smiling too, right? They're happy for this girl. And then you think, wait, it's Christmas night. And they're not with their own families. There's a whole story there that I don't think the people who took the photograph thought about.
Precisely. That is the sense of again, reading the photo for more than the initial image. And one reason also these photos strike me as ghostly is because they also show us what was absent at the time. And so because I've scrounged these photos entirely from affluent West Fort Worth neighborhoods. As you say, there are almost no black and brown faces, and those few that are there tend to be in the role of a servant or a caricature. There is very little sense of gender diversity. You can see the rigidity of binary gender roles in these photos, by the way women dress and men dress, and by what you see women doing as a group and what you see men doing. So before we romanticize these photos or think of them nostalgically, which there is some merit to that, we also have to be critical about the fact that they also are incidental or accidental records of racial inequality, residential segregation, strictly enforced gender roles. They're not simply happy photos of happy times. They also import those kinds of past memories into our present lives, too.
Jeff, you admit in the book to a kind of reflexive contempt, maybe is the word, for wealthy people or pampered wealthy people. Do these photographs always tend to reinforce that kind of disgust with their self-satisfaction, or do they ever cause you to question whether your assumptions might be too hasty?
That's a troubling question, a very good one. I would say many of them are worse than I could imagine in terms of the unexamined privilege and sheer indulgence that comes with great wealth. And so in that sense, I'm sometimes amazed just how indulgent the images are, or at least how they document indulgence. But I will say the way that I find it challenging is that I've more than once found pictures that suggest great levels of affluence in the past generation or two, but pictures that suggest before that maybe that family were dirt farmers in West Texas. You know, typically we might suggest before they found oil or before they hit it rich. So it's funny that in the same set of, seemingly the same set of family photos, you can see generational changes as well. And as some of the photos in the book show, there is very much the sense of the old barbed wire, you know, Texas hard scrabble homestead that often predates the affluence that comes around later on.
They're not all of human subjects. There's one where we see, it looks like maybe a telephone line, and way off in the distance is this tiny little community of homes. Who knows how densely populated that exact same area is today, but you get this sense of like excitement, like we finally got phones in this part of Texas.
It's a great point. It's fascinating what, at least we can assume, people found significant, as you say. So that may be that there's, of course, many photos of the new car, often posed very similarly with someone leaning on the driver's side door. But there are also photos, for example, one photo of a probably 100-year-old photo of a woman seems to be showing off a new oil tank that came with a new factory. So perhaps that factory finally got built or she worked there. Again, we don't know. But you're right. And of course, animals and pets feature a good bit. So you're right. There is a certain sense that you're reimagining and empathizing with what mattered to folks and what they found worth documenting. Again, the further irony that now they don't find it worth documenting. Now it's been discarded.
Every once in a while, people have written on these pictures, and there's a couple of different photos of the same dog. And somebody writes, last photo of, I can't remember the dog's name.
Yes, Boy.
Boy, last photo of Boy. Like, they knew the end was coming for this dog, and they wanted to make sure they had pictures.
That one, I almost choke up as an animal lover talking about, and that's where the title of the book comes from, because I found these old photos of this elderly dog. In fact, on the back of some of the photos, it said, Boy, age 17. So that's quite old for a dog. And as I went through those, I realized there was the last picture, which they had actually labeled it last picture. And as you say, there's a ghost again. I'm sad to say there is a dog who's about to be gone, and they caught him. And by the way, another touching part of that is he's not fully in the frame. They caught him sort of halfway in the frame. So
you imagine him sort of milling around, right?
Right, and maybe on his way out, or you know. And so the sense of that is folk art. I mean, the sense of that is how someone chose to shoot that photo, what they chose to photograph, and how that tells us about their relationship with the dog and their memories, again, I find tremendously poignant. And my colleagues, Gavin Morris and Fraser Stables, who, by the way, were the ones who really organized the photos, they're curators and artists, we finally realized that was the title of the book, was what that last photo said on the back of it as Boy was leaving us.
My grandfather gave me a camera for Christmas in second grade, and his instruction was to take pictures of his elderly dog. And it wasn't the kind of thing he could have allowed himself to do. He was kind of a tough old guy, but giving me this assignment, I think, let him know he would get these pictures. Of course, they all had my thumb in them because it was a little point and shoot from the 1970s.
Right, right. And by the way, I have to say, the thumb over the photo is a theme that you find often. And a couple of photos in the book are, one, for example, is a misty, odd, grainy photo of a woman in the far distance among seemingly sand dunes or perhaps a beach. So that was an interesting choice to begin with. But then someone's thumb, well, obviously the photographer's, was over the lens. So now you have this amorphous gray blob in the foreground. It almost makes it more surreal or more indecipherable because of the sort of the aesthetics of the thumb, how often a thumb intrudes from one side or the other into the lens.
So pretty much every photograph in this book comes to us with no context whatsoever, but it made me think a lot about the fact that every time we look at a picture, we bring context from our own lives to our interpretation, but we normally think that the way to interpret a photo is pretty objective.
Right. And we did that very intentionally, by the way, the sense that these photos were part of lives we can't know. They were then discarded. And so in that sense, they were hidden away and lost in the trash. They've now been rediscovered. They've earned their ambiguity. These are not photos that have been carefully chronicled or part of a museum exhibit. These are trash that was meant to be trash if had I not intervened. So as we thought about how to put together the book, we realized we don't really want to caption them. We don't want to make it obvious that here's the section of photos on pets or here's the best or worst photos, but in a sense to let the photos, this is never quite the case, but let them speak for themselves in all of their uncertainty and ambiguity. And I will offer a clue, should one choose to look at the book, that each photo in the book of the 100 or so that are in the book out of the many tens of thousands I have were picked for a reason. But we don't necessarily want to explicate that reason. So sometimes it's about the nature of the photo or the aesthetic. Sometimes it's about the subject matter. we wanted to leave that up to the reader or the viewer to think about why these photos mattered and why these might be the best photos in some sense out of all those other thousands.
When you did the gallery exhibition, were these reproduced in a larger format, or did you have the photos in their original size mounted?
The photos were in their original size. So in that sense, you know, to cover a couple of walls as we did with the photos involved thousands of photos. And so, by the way, I did a talk at the Modern in Fort Worth a couple of nights ago in which the photos were projected the size of a movie screen. And I found it really startling to see them in that detail and at that size, because again, the materiality of the old photographic technology was you had a 4x6 card in a sense, or a 3x5 card, whereas now, of course, we can make photos as large or small as we want to.
It's funny. I found myself trying to pinch out on a couple of them just because I wanted to get more detail of something.
Yes. And that's the other way in which you begin to see them as documents is when they're very well and carefully photographed, as Fraser Staples, one of my collaborators, did, the photo almost lifts off the page because it's not only the image, it's the actual photo of the photo with its crinkles. And as you saw in the book, some still have the tape attached to them where they were taped into an album, and some have dirt or marks on them. So they become documents as physical artifacts as well as documents of images.
That torn photograph that I mentioned in the introduction, that actually exists in this book. When you find things like that are ripped in half, what do you think?
Oh, well, again, it's very tempting to write the story about the divorce or the breakup. And I found wedding albums where, again, all the photos were torn in half, or I found wedding albums where all the photos were torn out. So I don't think, again, we have the right to tell their story that we don't know. But I think we can reasonably assume some level of discord or divorce or divergence in their lives. And so, as you say, those torn photos are really remarkable things. Again, today we might digitally alter a photo to get rid of the old boyfriend. In that period, you simply tore him out of out of the photo. A colleague raised the issue by finding that photo in the trash. Who kept what? That is, did
I had that question too? Yeah.
Did he keep that, or did she keep her but throw him away? It's a very tangled story. Again, another ghost story.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. First up is Toby calling us from Richardson. Hi, Toby.
Howdy. Really interesting program. This was back in probably the late 80s, and it was before I think the term dumpster diving even existed. But a man who lived in a really large house in Dallas behind the small apartment complex that I lived, his family came. He died. His family came and literally didn't go through anything, put absolutely everything out on the curb, which included perfect condition 15x20 Persian rug, a lovely Victorian gilded mirror. There were boxes and boxes of paper Mexican currency, which unfortunately had already been decommissioned, and lots of other things. I still wear some of the cowboy shirts that were thrown away, and apparently didn't go for anything. But there were also boxes and boxes and boxes of family photo albums and loose photos and a leather satchel that said important family papers. And I was wondering if you had ever found a really large selection of like what seemed to be an entire family history in one dump. I've always thought it when I run across those, I always think of those pictures as looking at ghosts, because you know everybody in them has got to be gone. But it was very poignant, and I just don't understand how a family could throw away an entire history.
Thanks for calling.
I have found that many times. That's a very good point, where in a sense, as you say, someone's entire life has been left intact in some sense because it's not been divided and yet entirely discarded. I'll say quickly, I found at one point an elderly doctor's life on the curb a few years ago, including his medical diploma, his marriage certificate. As you say, those sort of all the meaningful markers of his life. I also realized through some documents that were in there that he came from a prominent family in Hillsboro, Texas. So I contacted the authorities, I guess, in Hillsboro. And a month later, I was sitting in the parlor of the mayor, who was very grateful that I had provided them with these documents that would now go into the local museum. So sometimes you can put the family back together. But as you say, and I think we should in some ways forgive the family who in a moment of trauma and stress and trying to plan a funeral and deal with the estate maybe simply doesn't have the emotional energy, much less the time, to go through all the goods. So I think it's tragic to find someone's life on the curb, but I can understand how it might happen.
We're also conditioned to pose and smile for pictures if we know they're being taken. Do you think a lot about the fact that makes probably 90% of the pictures we take in some way kind of a lie of that moment.
Absolutely. One of my favorite musicians, rest in peace, John Prine, in one of his lyrics called Flashback Blues, the song, he sang photographs of the laughs taken in between the bad times. And so, as you say, for many reasons, as some we've already talked about, you would not want to take a collection of these photos as documents of the time, but rather documents of moments, events, choices that people made. And I have to say, my favorite photos in that sense are the ones that didn't quite come out. They snapped the shirt at the wrong time. The dog ran out of the frame. And so despite our attempt to sort of pose ourselves for our memories and our images, I love the ones that didn't quite work and the pose didn't hold. And therefore, perhaps we see a little different sense of everyday life.
There's one I love of three probably teenage girls in, their hair's in curlers and they're in nightgowns. And there's a picture taken and all three of them are giving like a dirty look. You just feel like it was little sister who was kept out of the sleepover or little brother who was trying to be a pest taking this picture. And it's like a very real moment.
It is. It feels that in that sense, it perhaps is from the 60s, let's guess, but it still feels like teenage life. The look on their face is that mix of disdain and embarrassment. With a little bit of humor, I think, as I recall, a little bit of a smile, too. And as you say, you know, under their blanket at the sleepover, hair and curlers, what a moment that is in terms of gender and family and siblings and all sorts of things.
Tell us about Grandma on the bicycle.
Oh, that's one I've thought a lot about. So it's an early exercise bike that's on the little small back porch of someone's fairly sparse backyard. And Grandma is, we certainly would typify her as a grandma, is riding the bicycle, but she's thrown her arms up in the air and seems to be in a sort of happy, exuberant state. And as I've talked about in other contexts, I'm not sure whether to laugh along with her or whether I might be misreading that. It strikes me as that's Grandma having a good time and showing off for the grandkids. And so in that sense, I enjoy the photo. I suppose there's the possibility she lost control of the exercise bike and threw her arms up in the air. But it seems more, as you say, more her decision to present herself that way, maybe show the grandkids that Grandma's not as old as you think. So those I especially enjoy.
How often do you really, really want to know the story of the people you find in these pictures?
Always, but I've learned not to yearn for it too much because the yearning is never satisfied. By the way, speaking of that and where that can lead you, at one point I was going through some photos of a scout troop, and I realized I know this guy. I know him now as an adult. I know this must have been his scout troop, and his mom is apparently the scout leader or the den mother. And so I excitedly called him and said, you won't believe this. I don't know how they got there, but I just found 30 or 40 photos of you and your friends. He said, I do not want to see them. I don't want to hear about them. I don't want them back. So in that sense, you have to be careful if you do uncover the story. What are you uncovering? I still don't know. I didn't press further, but perhaps there was a trauma there or some bad memories. And so maybe he had thrown those away or had previously gotten rid of them in some other context. So even if you could uncover the story, I think you'd have to be very careful as to what emotions and memories you raise, not only for yourself, but for those who were involved in the photography.
So my husband used to have a saying when my kids were small, if they would pick up a piece of trash, on a walk or something, that once you've picked it up, it's your responsibility, right? Once you've picked up these photos, they're your responsibility.
That's the rough part, and my partner would agree. I have a very small house and a very small office in that house that has a very small closet, and about 2/3 of that closet is now boxes of old photos. I suppose there might be a sort of zen completing of the circle to put them back in the trash, but I can't do that. I displayed them, of course, in this book and elsewhere. That raises issues of voyeurism and whether I really have the moral or legal right to own these. I suppose I do, but I'm not comfortable entirely with that. So as you say, once you acquire them, just like your husband's caution to your kids, they're now yours to deal with. I thought about the Frankenstein metaphor, that I have breathed the monster back into life from things that otherwise would have been long gone and long forgotten. And now I have thousands of ghosts inhabiting my closet.
Really. This project also raises questions about, it's easy to look back and be sad and nostalgic about things we've cast aside. And then there's also some necessity to do that, right? We would never progress as a society if we only focused on what's come before.
Precisely. And we would also never have room for ourselves or our children if we kept every memento of every previous generation. So while we might imagine we would like to do that, in fact, we have to make those kinds of difficult choices. So I think you're right. It's difficult not to end up in very deep thoughts about the transience of human life and the tragedy of life and death and the pathos of people's changing lives. My Latin teacher in high school, sic transit gloria mundi, was one of the first phrases we learned. So passes the glory of the world, and so it does pass. And by the way, when not only you find once treasured photos, but when you find, as I often do, award plaques and trophies and diplomas, you realize even the most significant achievements becomes trash eventually.
Let's go back to the phones. Kirk is on the line in Glen Rose, Texas. Hi, Kirk.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm feeling very guilty now listening to your guest. My mother passed away about 8 years ago, and I have two huge boxes of not only photographs, but my father was in World War II, and she cut out headlines of events that occurred where he was. She didn't cut out the stories, just the headlines. And so I don't know what to do with all of these pictures and these headlines and these mementos. They were obviously very important to her, but my children don't want them, and I'm really guilty about throwing them away. Does your guest have any guidance about what to do in this situation?
Thanks
and
for
I'll
your call.
Listen to his answer off the air.
Thanks for that question. People ask me this all the time, imagining that I might have the answer when, in fact, I'm the one with the closet full of, of 10,000 photos. I think that's an essential dilemma. We want to respect our parents and our grandparents and what mattered to them, but we simply don't have room in our lives. One solution my brother, by the way, came up with when my father passed away was to take a series of photos and pick the one that seemed to best encapsulate that moment or that event, and then, sad to say, discard the 20 that were simply other photos of that birthday or that sort of thing. And of course, while I'm not a big digital fan, scanning them offers the possibility of putting them in, at least in a digital form. I think you lose something clearly when you lose the tactile sensuality of the actual photo or the old headline, but there you at least could keep the memory and the images without quite so many boxes full of photos.
It's interesting to think that the Jeff Ferrell of 50 years from now may have to be searching around on the cloud to find people's discarded photographs.
That's something that there's a reason that we who have been teachers and professors want to train the next generation to be critical scholars, because they'll know things we don't know, and the world changes and they change with it. I have no idea how to do that kind of research, but I hope someone out there, maybe a younger person or someone with better technical skills, can think about what would it mean to scrounge discarded images. And as someone raised the other day, is there such a thing as a discarded image in the cloud, or, as we suspect fearfully, are they all in fact somehow kept and chronicled in some database that we don't know about? So, you know, what is a discarded image on the web, and how would one find it and collect it?
How does this work affect your choice about when to take a picture?
I take very few pictures, actually, partly because I'm sort of a recalcitrant old guy, and I see people seemingly living their lives via their viewfinder on their phone. And so I almost make a point of not recording what I've done, but also it's because I suppose I see that produces such a surfeit of images that at some point, even whether digitally or materially, you're overwhelmed by them. So I guess partly what this has induced me to do is actually take less images and to think about, as the guest was just suggesting on the phone, what will become of those when it's time for me to pass on or move on.
I read some really interesting research once that people remember events less well when they spend a lot of time during that event taking pictures, which is just such an ironic thing.
I think you're right. And I don't know that to be true, but I that's certainly my suspicion. And also, I think the more photos we take of an event, the more we stage the event for the camera. And so it becomes not the birthday party, but the performance of the birthday party for those who are taking photos of it. That's not inherently bad, but that is a different thing. I would rather really live in the moment, maybe a shot here or there, but try not to make it simply something to be photographed.
Yeah, we've all been to that party where the cake tastes terrible, but it looks beautiful on Instagram.
Right. And I won't say who, but I had a relative growing up who would restage moments. So, you know, let's rewrap the present because I didn't get a good photo of it now and wrap it again. Or wait, put the slice back in the cake. We're going to shoot that over again. It's like sort of like a Hollywood director. So I think that's not just a recent phenomenon, but maybe the technology to do that is all the more powerful than it once was.
All right, let's go back to the phones. The number is 800-933-5372. Katie is on the line in Dallas. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I have lost my parents both this year. And just talking about finding all these old photos in the trash and how it feels a little tragic, I'm feeling a lot of guilt because there are things that they kept that are not important to me and that I will be discarding, but I feel terribly guilty about it. How do I reconcile that in my mind and not keep beating myself up about it?
Well, thanks for your call, Katie, and I'm really sorry for so much loss in a single year.
Katie, I offer my sympathy as well, and you face the dilemma that all of us face. The one thing I would say is I think your guilt and concern about getting rid of those images is suggestive of how much you loved your parents and how deep those relationships were. So in a sense, I think the more difficult it is to get rid of the mementos, the more it validates that we cared about those folks and they cared about us. I've long fantasized about some sort of folk art collection, not in the traditional sense of folk art perhaps, but folk art in terms of all those old images and old mementos that families need to discard being saved somewhere. I suppose we'd end up with a warehouse full of them, but wouldn't that be lovely if a community beyond their sort of official museum could have simply a repository of lost memories and lost images so that by getting them out of our lives, it wouldn't mean necessarily losing them forever.
Do any of your colleagues in different academic disciplines have interest in these photographs for different reasons than you might look at them as a sociologist?
Well, I've been lucky, again, in working with this book with Gavin and Fraser and throughout my career to stumble into alliances and collaborations with photographers. And I'm not just being nice to photographers, but they really have taught me a different way of looking at the world. And so I think in that sense, photography friends see these photos as, again, photographic history and can read into them what kind of film was used, what kind of processing or development process led to that. And you see that in different forms of deterioration. Some bleed through from the back, some turn yellow, some you can see the writing on the back as the paper deteriorates. And so what that's taught me to think about is, again, these photos as both images, but also as material artifacts of photographic history. You know, I'm not trained in this, but we've had the daguerreotype and the tintype. We've had different material mediums by which we record images. And so in that sense, these photos are a history of a particular time, largely the 20s through the 1980s or 90s, where cameras were increasingly available to people. But as you suggested, film was shot and then sent off for development. One reason I think we have so many interesting photos from this period is precisely because people could not see what they were getting and had to send the roll off. And once it was developed, even a, quote, bad photo tended to be kept with the others. So thankfully, I think you couldn't look in your digital camera and see if that shot was any good. It had to be saved anyway and became part of that kind of muddled, ambiguous history of people's actual lives.
I don't know how often you look back at pictures of your own life or whether they're stored somewhere else, you know, pictures from your childhood. But do you ever think about what some stranger would make of a picture that makes perfect sense to you and your family?
I very much do. And again, that's part of the fun of looking at these photos is to think that photo seems to be nonsensical or seems to be absurd. But maybe, again, that exercise bike was brand new, or maybe that far off image, as you suggested in that one photo, was because they wanted to catch the landscape as well as the daughter, that sort of thing. So it's interesting. Again, I'm always careful. I don't want to assume I figured it out. But it's interesting to imagine what any of our images would mean to someone else who didn't know why that mattered, why that chair was the one to seat the child in, that kind of thing. I think it also creates a kind of humility, is that our most treasured photos matter, but they maybe don't matter in a broader sense any more than anyone else's photos do. And maybe all we really have eventually is a kind of collective memory as our individual memories fade away.
All right. I want to go back to the phones. The number is 800-933-5372. Let's see. We have Cheryl calling us from Southlake. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello. Oh, this program speaks to me so much because I'm sort of the gatherer of all the photographs for our family from past generations. And I guess I wanted to ask, I know most of his, your guest doesn't really know who they came from or anything, but the thing that really bothers me is that so many family photos do not have any indication of who people are in them. And it really makes me really want to label all of my people in my pictures. How often do you find clues like on the backs of the photos or what the event was or who the people were? Is that something that is there sometimes or?
Thank you. I love that question. I'm glad you asked it. As some of the photos in the book show, in the book we have some photos that you see the front and the back. And again, the back says, boy, the dog, age 17, this sort of thing. So and by the way, another interesting thing is that often, and especially in the older photos, people wrote with seemingly, obviously, a fountain pen. You can see that kind of ink on the front of the photo. And many of them have an arrow. It says Uncle Bill with an arrow pointing through the photo to the head of the person. So not much respect for the photo, but again, as you're suggesting, an attempt to let the grandkids or someone in the future generation know. What I find especially interesting about these in terms of the kind of ghostly absence of information is that often the notation on the back of the photo will say Uncle Billy's friend or Susan's boyfriend. And of course, we don't know who Susan is any longer. And so you realize those notations were meant to be read by family members who would know Susan or Uncle Billy. But for those of us who might come across those photos, they don't really tell us much more than the photo itself. I don't know any more about Uncle Billy seeing his name on the back than I do seeing his image on the front.
Is there something about a project like this that can help us all get more comfortable with not just the fact that we'll be gone someday, but with the fact that we'll be forgotten? The truth is, 100 years from now, almost none of us will be remembered by anyone. And that's just the way the world goes. We're not necessarily pining to know the people who were really important a century ago.
Right. I would say that's the deepest lesson. Again, I don't mean to sound overly theological or philosophical, but the deepest lesson this has taught me in 40 years now of scrounging people's lost mementos and trophies and diplomas and photos is that we might as well try to be humble about our lives and see ourselves as part of a larger species and a larger world, because if we think that our individual achievements are going to matter much in the long run, they're probably not. I would like to think, back to the movie It's a Wonderful Life, that our influence on people will linger and that our good deeds will be handed down. But in terms of achievements and photographic memories and diplomas, it's dust in the wind.
How did you select out of thousands the several dozen pictures for this book?
I don't mean to be evasive, but in fact, it was a bit of an evasive process. I and Fraser and Gavin, we talked about it a great deal, and this project's been years in the making, but we never specified any sort of criterion by which we wanted to pick out the photos. We simply tried to take them as their own object, take them as the thing itself, and think about the ones that seemed to matter most or that intrigued us the most or that photographically suggested some odd combination of techniques. And so I'm not sure we know why we picked these 100 out of the 10,000, but I'm not sure we wanted to know. I want to preserve these photos mystery, and I want to sort of let the ghost be. I've dug the ghost back up, but I don't feel a need to overly explain them or guide someone else in terms of how they see them. So I think the book is intentionally not obvious in terms of why these photos would have been picked. We knew when we found the right ones, but we didn't really want to talk about too much about why that was.
Do you have some system for categorizing them just in your home office?
Oh, that's, again, a great question. I did once. When I began to realize how many were accumulating, I thought, I'll be a good researcher and a good cataloger, and I'll start making folders like pets and urban scapes and family photos. And then I realized that seems to me unfair to the photos. The photos were not presented to me that way, and they weren't kept by families that way. Families didn't have a separate album for urban shots. Those were in among the family photos. So it struck me that given what they meant to families, as best I could know, and given the condition in which I found them, that again, they deserve to not be overly clarified. It wasn't fair to divide them into strict categories when that was not how they lived in the world. And I'll say one other thing too, that only came to me recently. We think of these photos as being inexorably linked to the photographer that took them or the subject of the photo or the family, but they also are inexorably at this point trash. In other words, all of these photos have become at some point discards. And so in a sense, I think we need to respect the fact that these photos are meaningful, but also became less meaningful or were lost through family changes, and to let them be who they are and not try to sort of restore them to some kind of strict interpretation.
You have 15 seconds. Is there something people can do who are going to discard things that may be useful if they're not going to donate them? Can they make the job easier of people scrounging for useful items?
Oh, sure. Put it beside the dumpster, not in it. And I promise you that once I take what people can use, I'll put it in the dumpster and clean up.
Jeff Farrell is a sociologist, author, and founding and current editor of the New York University Press book series Alternative Criminology. His new book is called Last Picture. Jeff, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us again.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed it very much.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at the handle at KERA Think. We hope that you'll subscribe to the Think podcast, which you can find by searching anywhere you get podcasts for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.